today, what does this election mean for the NHS? And Dan Collins on the resignation of Bolivian President Evo Morales. People love the NHS.
It's the institution that makes people most proud to be British. It's more trusted than the royal family or Team GB in the Olympics or the armed forces.
And don't politicians know it?
Our NHS is not for sale.
It is time for us to say loud and clear, we are the party of the NHS.
So all the evidence shows that love of it, affection for it, cuts across party political boundaries. On a practical level, any of us individually and our families and our loved ones rely on it at birth, at death, and many times in between.
It's because voters rely on it and love it that the NHS is at the heart of this general election. But Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn have very different visions about how to run the health service, leading to rows about privatisation, drug prices, and a possible trade deal with Donald Trump.
Look, I think everything with a trade deal is on the table. When you're dealing in trade, everything's on the table.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, is the NHS up for sale? The NHS is famous across the world as a state-owned and state-run health system. But there are private companies involved in it. When did that begin?
Although Labour now, under Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell, are seeking to make great political capital and political trouble for Boris Johnson & Co. about privatising the NHS, it was actually their party, the Labour Party, that took the most substantial steps towards introducing private companies.
Dennis Campbell is health policy editor for The Guardian and The Observer.
That was under Tony Blair in the early noughties, 2002-03, in response to large numbers of people waiting long times for planned operations, things like a cataract removal, a hernia repair, a new hip or knee being fitted, something like that.
Waiting lists have come down dramatically. Treatment for things like heart disease and cancer are completely transformed.
The Blair government issued a number of contracts for what were called ISTCs, Independent Sector Treatment Centres. They were basically bulk contracts for privately run medical facilities to do lots and lots of these operations to get the politically unacceptable waiting lists down.
Okay, so that happened under New Labour. In 2010, the Tories came to power.
It is only three letters long, but in its letters lie the hopes of...
David Cameron said that his priority was NHS. The narrative is that the Tories allowed creeping privatisation beyond what we'd seen before that. Is that true?
That's right. It's true that the amount of money going to private companies has been going up every year for the last 5 or 6 years, at least. It's very hard to get absolutely exact figures of this. The Department of Health's annual accounts that come out every July show that in 2014-15, it was 8.07 billion. And last year, 2018-19, it had gone up to 9.2 billion.
So out of a total of what?
That's out of a total of 125 billion in England last year. And that's about 7% of the budget. Just in the last few days, The Guardian has reported that the number of patients who the NHS has paid for to be operated on in private hospitals in England has pretty much doubled since the Conservatives came to power in 2010, from roughly 300,000 people a year to over 600,000 people a year.
And what are the arguments for driving up private provision?
Well, the arguments are that the NHS, as we see almost every day in the news, visibly cannot cope with the demands being placed upon it. Demands for NHS care are going up at the rate of 4, 5, 6, 7% a year. The NHS budget and staffing and capacity to do things in terms of operating theatres and so on is not keeping pace with that. Therefore, increasingly, NHS trusts in England are having to do little deals with local private hospitals to take on 50 patients here, 100 patients there, and do them to keep their own individual trust waiting lists down. You also have the, for the government, politically difficult reality that the total number of people waiting in England for a planned non-urgent operation hospital is now over 4.4 million people. That is a lot. So one in every 15 people in England is waiting for an operation. Many of them are waiting for many, many, many months, sometimes over 6 months and occasionally over a year. Therefore, the private sector is back in the space now where it's increasingly winning contracts now because the NHS can't cope.
And why don't they spend that taxpayer money on increasing their own resources rather than on private companies?
Because the main thing the NHS lacks, staff, doctors and nurses particularly, they all take time to train. And one of the NHS's signal failures, or the government's signal failures in recent years towards the NHS, has been a catastrophic loss of focus on the workforce problem. And it's taken them far too long to realise the scale of the problem. And the nature of the problem means that 10 years to train a doctor, 3-4 years to train a nurse or a midwife, that it takes ages and ages to turn that ship around.
Who are the companies who get awarded the contracts?
There are literally hundreds and hundreds of private companies that provide healthcare on a small or large scale to the NHS in England. Probably the best known that we at The Guardian have focused on a lot in recent years is Virgin Care, one of Richard Branson's companies. It, at the last count, had more than 400 different contracts to provide different sorts of care and different sorts of services for the NHS in England. The private hospital group Spire Hospitals, they do quite a lot of these operations. So there's a vast array. Most of them are not names that are known to the public, and some of them operate only on a very localised basis, and there's very few that are kind of big companies.
Okay, so that's the current state of play. What has the impact been on care?
So, in truth, it's a mixed picture. It would be unfair to suggest that all privately provided healthcare is of poor quality. It's definitely not. Quite a lot of the services that are provided are run perfectly, adequately. There are no problems raised about them by patients, by regulators, by staff groups, anything like that. But we have seen some significant problems. There is a long and sorry history of private providers winning contracts from NHS organisations, usually by undercutting them in price to quite a large degree, and then finding, surprise, surprise, that they can't provide the quality of care in the way it's expected, and either having the contract taken away from them or sometimes, shamefully, hand the contract back because they can't deliver it properly. Because healthcare is expensive and complicated. It's not an easy thing to make money out of. Several years ago on the south coast of England, a company called Co-Performer won a country to provide non-urgent patient transport services, taking people requiring healthcare to and from hospital appointments. Not kind of sexy stuff, not involving blue lights, not the stuff of TV dramas, but really, really important for the patients and their families. And they hugely undercut the local NHS ambulance service that had been doing it for years and years. And the quality of service went to rack and ruin literally almost from day one. Cancer patients weren't being taken in for their operations. Kidney patients weren't going in for their dialysis. All those things, ambulances weren't turning up. There was a huge outcry, and rightly, they lost that contract.
Now, after 7 months of misery, the controversial company is to be stripped of its contract. All of Sussex Care commissioning groups agreeing to let it go.
And there's been quite a lot of examples like that.
And that's physical health, but the private sector is being heavily used in mental health services, isn't it?
There's a real emerging problem now about privately funded inpatient mental health care. Since the start of 2017, the Care Quality Commission, the NHS regulator in England, has issued very critical reports and or put into special measures no fewer than 30 different private mental health hospitals in England.
Wow.
30 in less than 3 years. And private companies are making, I think it's about £1.5 billion a year now of the NHS budget goes to privately provided mental health care.
That's incredibly worrying. I mean, have the government acknowledged these problems? Do they accept privatisation maybe to blame? Have they done anything to rein it in?
What's interesting about NHS privatisation as a political issue now is that certainly Theresa May's government accepted publicly in detail the need to greatly roll back privatisation of NHS care in England. And recently, NHS England produced the legislative proposals, the basis for a bill to unwind a lot of the increased competition outsourcing that flowed from the Andrew Lansley Health and Social Care Act back in 2012. It's unclear yet whether Boris Johnson has the same desire that Theresa May did to roll this back.
Would you rule out expanding the use of the private sector in the health service?
Look, we are putting £34 billion.
He recently did an interview with the BBC's Laura Koonsberg, and she asked him, would you continue the extension of privatisation of the NHS? And surprisingly to me, he didn't say no.
And what I will tell you, well, you know, of course that you know, there are dentists and optometrists and so on who are...
That's interesting, because it's pretty clear to me that the Tories worry about the NHS as an issue. They know that voters really care about it, and they know that they have historically got a bad reputation.
The NHS has been destroyed.
I mean, members of the public and staff have confronted Boris Johnson on his endless hospital visits.
A press opportunity.
Well, actually, there's no press here.
What do you mean there's no press here? Who are these people?
Dominic Cummings, the Tories' chief strategist, has been previously filmed, basically suggesting that a lot of Tory MPs don't care about the NHS.
What's one of the core problems of the Tory party brand going back decades?
NHS,
and people think, by the way, and I think most people are right, the Tory party is run by people who basically don't care about people like me.
So they're trying to show that they do care about this. But is it about perception rather than reality?
So NHS privatisation politically is tricky, particularly for the Tories, for whom it appears to be toxic. Recently, just last week, The Guardian got hold of a leaked copy of a set of instructions, a handbook, in effect, that Conservative Central Office had sent to every Tory prospective parliamentary candidate around the country, telling them, amongst other things, if you're asked about privatisation of the NHS, don't sign up things, don't say things, don't commit to things, don't sign up to campaigns, make pledges that we as a party and as a putative government can't stand over. And that certainly adds up to a picture of uncertainty and indeed concern about what a Johnson government, if there is one, on December the 13th might do.
All of that really helps to explain why this has become such a central issue in this election, not least because Labour under Jeremy Corbyn is a very different party than it was under Tony Blair. And they're very clear that they are very critical of the use of private companies in the NHS. What is Labour's position on this?
On the BBC Andrew Marr show recently, the Labour Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell said that a Labour government would let all existing contracts come to a natural end.
They should be brought in-house because we believe in a democratic NHS, and we believe actually we shouldn't be allowing people to profiteer from the NHS.
All of those services for care would be returned to the NHS, that they would be insourced, to use the current jargon. Instead of being outsourced, they would be insourced.
But you said that the NHS in its current state is not able to cope with demand. So how is it going to suddenly stop using private providers?
So Labour's policy sounds great. It goes down well at rallies. It probably goes down well on the doorstep. And it certainly connects with the great public concern that there is about this. But it's not very realistic. It's inconceivable that over the 5 years of a potential Labour government that the NHS would be able to train the number of staff, the significant number of extra staff needed to over time, over Parliament, take on doing all of this work, again, particularly in mental health care. It just is not possible.
Jeremy Corbyn is able to go around the country and say that the Tories will sell off the NHS and we will protect it.
Our NHS is not for sale.
But that's also because at the same time, we have the spectre of a possible trade deal with the United States.
So it sort of strikes me that the issue of what will happen to the NHS as a result of a post-Brexit UK-US trade deal is almost, in political campaigning terms for Labour, a gift from heaven, because they're now able to run two different arguments, neither of which Boris Johnson has an effective answer to. One, that the NHS will be much further privatised and in effect will be sold off chunk by chunk. And secondly, that the NHS's drugs bill will go through the roof. On the first one, there's very little reason to think that's right. But on the second one, they're definitely onto something.
For the Conservative Party, one of the driving missions of Brexit is to secure the freedom to do independent trade deals across the world, with the US seen as the greatest prize of all. The fears about the NHS being placed on the table in that negotiation are actually less about outsourcing care to private companies and more about medicines. Because the US pharmaceutical industry is huge and it's desperate to charge the NHS more for drugs.
I think it is a really big priority for Donald Trump. He has implied that he can't do a trade deal unless medicines are on the table.
Sarah Bosley is The Guardian's health editor.
This trade deal would definitely try to remove some of the barriers that the American pharma companies perceive at the moment.
When foreign governments extort unreasonably low prices from U.S. drug makers, Americans have to pay more to subsidize.
Donald Trump has complained that the same drugs in the same packaging are sold for hundreds of dollars in America, but a tiny amount in other countries, including in the UK.
It's unfair and it's ridiculous and it's not going to happen any longer.
Why are they so much cheaper here?
We have price controls because we do a health technology assessment to make sure that drugs are cost effective. So this is NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, which actually looks at each drug and says, OK, what does this do? Is this value for money? How much are we prepared to pay for the benefits it will give to patients?
And then they push the price down through that.
After NICE has made its assessment, you get NHS England these days and the other authorities as well that negotiate with the drug company. So that will push the price down because the NHS will simply say, look, you know, we would like to have your drug, please, but we simply can't afford to pay this price for it.
Why can't they have those negotiations in the US?
In the US, the state is actually forbidden from negotiating with the pharmaceutical companies. So it's a completely free market. And what happens is that the US companies can actually demand whatever price they want.
Why can they demand whatever price they want? Why doesn't competition drive down prices?
All medicines are patented to begin with, and that patent can start actually quite early on when they're still developing the drug. But the life of the patent after it's launched is about 12 years in the United States. That means a 12-year monopoly when no other company can make the same drug.
Are there many examples of drugs being sold at vastly different prices?
There are lots of drugs that are hugely different in price. There's been a huge fuss recently over Orkambi, which is a drug for cystic fibrosis. I have to say it's taken 4 years to negotiate a price for the NHS to buy this drug. It's an important drug because it's the first one that actually treats the underlying causes of cystic fibrosis and doesn't just help with the symptoms. But the price of this, and it's a drug made by an American company called Vertex, the price that they wanted was £104,000 per patient per year. And the NHS just said, look, we can't pay that. We've got 10,000 people with cystic fibrosis and at least half of them could be on this drug, which meant we simply said no. And there were various offers and a lot of negotiating. And eventually a deal has been done. We're not allowed to know exactly what that price is because it's commercially confidential. But you can bet your life it's an awful lot less.
Potentially a huge saving for the NHS, but also 4 years in which patients here didn't have access to that drug.
And in fact, Vertex has just got approval for another drug that's better than that one. And this is a triple combination called Trikafta. And they are asking £240,000 per patient per year for that one. This is going to raise all the same issues. So patients will be agonised, doctors will be completely frustrated, and the NHS will not be able to afford that drug at that price. So look forward to a whole new round of negotiating on that as well.
But in the end, the NHS does often get cheaper prices, perhaps because of its buying power. And you can understand Donald Trump's frustration.
We are putting American patients first.
He says patients there are paying a huge amount towards research and development, presumably paying those high prices that you're talking about compared to other countries. I mean, does he have a point?
Well, a lot of people will not agree with that at all. They say, for starters, drugs are massively overpriced. And actually, the amount that they say that they spend on research and development is hugely hyped. So a lot of the costs of research and development are borne by universities and academics. So the figures have been hugely disputed. And an awful lot of people around the world would say that the Americans are actually paying far too much for drugs.
And we know they care about this because in the negotiating objectives from the US in terms of a trade deal with the UK, published in February this year, there was a very clear paragraph that said pharmaceuticals will be trying to get that full market access.
So there's pressure on the Trump administration actually to incorporate all of this in a trade deal. I think he's serious about that. And we do know actually that there have been discussions between trade officials in the US and the UK about what they could do.
Okay, so the concern around the trade deal is about the price of drugs. And if those go up, fewer patients getting access to them. But the debate around this rarely feels that specific. People talk about the NHS much more broadly.
I can't hear him.
It's the National Health Service. He says, should the National Health Service be on the table?
One minute, Donald Trump is stood next to Theresa May saying it's on the table.
So NHS or anything else, or a lot more than that. But everything will be on the table, absolutely.
Then he backtracks and says it's off the table.
I don't see it being on the table.
Is it or not?
I think the NHS is not on the table and never will be because, you know, there's such a strong feeling in this country about it. But medicines are a different thing. Medicines are a commodity. And Donald Trump undoubtedly will look at them in the same way that he'll look at oil or food. He's going to say, yes, we need a fair deal as we see it for our drugs and we want free access to the NHS market because the NHS is the buyer of drugs. But that simply means that the prices are going to have to go up and the NHS will have to pay a lot more for its medicines.
How much could it cost the NHS?
Well, Andrew Hill, who's a professor at Liverpool who specialises in this sort of thing, says it could go up, our bill could go up from $18 billion to $45 billion a year. And that's about $500 million a week.
So that's more than the $350 million extra a week promised on the side of that red bus during the Brexit vote.
Certainly is, yes.
That's a lot of other things that the NHS could be spending money on.
I mean, there are people who say that that's a bit of an exaggeration because he's looked at the overall UK spending on drugs and simply worked it out because the US spends about 2.5 times more than we do on their drugs. So it's a straight extrapolation from one to the next. But even if you look at the 20 drugs that cost the most to the NHS, you still get a hike. It's about half that, but it's still a big hike in the drugs bill.
But the Trade Secretary, Liz Truss, has said that won't happen. She wrote recently, the Prime Minister, the Health Secretary and myself have been crystal clear. The NHS is not and never will be up for sale. This is a categoric red line. She added, the price the NHS pays for drugs won't be on the table. Do you trust that?
I think that if Trump makes a real point of this, and I think he is going to, then they will have to concede something. No, I shouldn't think the drugs bill will go up quite as dramatically as Andrew Hill predicts in his worst possible expectations. But I do think that something will have to give because the Americans think this is a point of principle.
Do they have drugs in other trade deals?
They do. And in fact, in South Korea, for instance, they have managed to put in clauses to a trade deal there to say that there won't be any health technology assessment. So they're not supposed to look at the cost effectiveness of medicines before they price them.
What's Labour's position on all of this?
Well, Labour actually is taking a very radical view indeed. They are saying we will decide that if patients need a drug badly, then we will allow a generic version to be made. And it's legal within the World Trade Organization rules on intellectual property.
Right, because Labour is arguing that there are safeguards that allow governments to override patents if the needs of the people outweigh the interests of the company. Now, the Tories say this could massively discourage research and development. Is that a risk?
That is always the argument. But there are various things in this. And one is that we're not actually getting always the drugs that we need. We're getting the drugs that we're offered by the pharmaceutical industry. So there are lots of arguments around access to medicines.
Dennis, given that the NHS is so central to this election, tell me what the ideological divide is between Labour and the Conservatives when it comes to the health service.
The NHS in this election is proving to be a very, very clear illustration of the vast ideological divide between the two parties. The Conservatives are led by a leader who back in 1995 wrote a leader in The Spectator saying that patients should be charged to access NHS care. People forget that, and he's not often asked about it. A lot of people around him, including members of the cabinet, historically been involved in right-wing think tanks that want to basically shrink the role of the NHS and expand the role of the private sector and bring in insurance for healthcare. They just keep it quiet at the moment because it's politically toxic. And then you've got Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell saying that, you know, under a future Labour government, everything that the NHS does will be provided by the NHS only. The classic ultra-statist view of healthcare, which, to be honest, seems to play well, not just at Labour rallies, but on the doorstep.
Dennis, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
That was Sarah Bosley and Dennis Campbell. They, along with other specialists across The Guardian, will be providing coverage of key policy areas throughout this election campaign. Do keep up on the website and do keep listening to us as we look at each of those areas in turn. Coming up, Dan Collins on the protest that toppled Evo Morales, Bolivia's first Indigenous president. Now, in Bolivia, popular pressure has just toppled the continent's longest-standing leader, Evo Morales. Once a darling of the international left, scandal and public demonstrations in the wake of a contested recent election have led Morales to resign and abandon a controversial fourth term. Dan Collins explains.
Well, this is obviously a huge development for Bolivia. Evo Morales has been the president since 2006. He was the country's first indigenous president. It was extremely important that this former coca leaf grower, a union leader, became president of a country which was hugely unequal. Of course, he was a leftist icon and it came to power with what's been called the pink tide of 2 decades ago, which brought in several leftist leaders across the region, including Hugo Chavez. With a commodity boom, he was able to use the profits from the nationalized gas industry and was responsible for taking the poorest country in Latin America and really making it less unequal. I've been spending a few days in La Paz, certainly in the build-up to this resignation, and the street protests have been constant, they've been colourful, they've been loud. In many ways, it started in 2016 when a referendum was held in which Morales asked whether he could have another term in office after having 3 terms in office. Still, of course, at that moment, a very popular leader in Bolivia, having won the last 2 elections with more than 60% of the vote. Well, as it turned out, the population of Bolivia voted no, and that really marked a turning point. Many people expressed gratitude to Evo Morales for what he's done with the country, but felt that he shouldn't stay in power for any longer and were concerned that he was just basically trying to stay president for life. When Morales in 2017 used the highest court in the country and allies within the judiciary to basically say that he was going to ignore the referendum, that really enraged a lot of Bolivians. There was a suspicion ahead of this election that Morales and his government might try to execute some kind of electoral fraud so that he could stay in office. When, of course, suspicions were aroused by a 24-hour stoppage in the quick vote count on October the 20th, then the allegations or suspicions of fraud really spread like wildfire and people took to the streets, not just in La Paz, but in cities across the country. 3 weeks later, the commander-in-chief of the armed forces urged Evo Morales to resign for, as he put it, the pacification of the country. And very shortly after, Morales appeared in a televised address announcing that he would resign, but also keeping some barbs for what he called the right, who he said were trying to basically oust him in a coup attempt.
Las hermanas y hermanos de Bolivia, a todo el mundo entero. Quiero informar desde la OKN.
At this stage, it's very difficult to say what might happen next in Bolivia. Probably the best possible scenario is for a new leader to be elected. It may not be that easy. There's reports covering the region and the high points of Evo Morales' time in office, what I would say I probably never expected to see Evo Morales resigning. It does represent a shift in the geopolitics of Latin America. His absence will be sorely felt by other leftist leaders in the region, particularly in Mexico and Argentina.
That was Dan Collins. Do follow his reporting at theguardian.com. My thanks to him and to Dennis Campbell and Sarah Bosley. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.